Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine approaches its fourth month, there's been historic unity among the countries of Europe against this Russian aggression. Questions remain how long that unity will last. But outside of Europe, Canada, and the United States, the rest of the world has viewed the invasion with ambivalence and resisted calls to sanction Russia or help Ukraine. Countries throughout Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Central and South America abstained in the UN vote condemning Russia, and many of these nations have maintained trade, diplomatic, and military ties. Why this difference? My guest today to help explain is Dr. Charles Ziegler, a professor of political science and a university scholar at the University of Louisville. He's a noted Russian specialist on that country's domestic, foreign, and security policies. He's authored numerous books and articles on Russia for prestigious journals and has been a contributor to media. He's held an International Affairs Fellowship at the Council of Foreign Relations and is the founder and senior scholar of the Center for Asian Democracy. And he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on Russia, shunned in Europe, but welcomed by the rest. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Charles Ziegler, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and welcome back to Tulsa. It's been a while.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a while, and it's great to be back here.
You're speaking about how the world has reacted to Russia's invasion of Ukraine outside of Europe as well as within Europe. And let's start by talking about the reaction within Europe. The near unanimity of response in Europe to Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been remarkable. Even in the depths of the Cold War, you know, the NATO alliance was not as united as it seems today. Have you been surprised by this reaction in Europe?
Well, I have. And if you look at, you know, what happened after the Cold War, there was this division between, you know, what Don Rumsfeld called the old Europe and the new Europe. With the newer Europe, the former socialist countries, Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic and so on, being pretty suspicious of Russia, while old Europe, meaning Germany and Spain, Italy, France, were really pretty well disposed to Russia. And that sort of division, even though it's a bit simplistic, was, I think, fairly accurate. And you just don't see that now. There are still certain countries, France with President Macron and Italy are, I think, trying to find more of a negotiated solution. But the rest of the other countries, Germany in particular, that has really been remarkable, how Germany has taken the lead in many respects on this. It's tough for them, given how much energy they import from Russia. And not just that, but Germany's got long-standing business ties to Russia. So this is pretty tough for them. And then you see it's even had an impact on neutral countries like Finland and Sweden, who are now looking to join NATO because of the perceived threat from Russia.
Yeah, Sweden laid out of World War II, and yet now here they are asking for NATO membership.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much akin to Switzerland joining the alliance. I mean, they have this long history of neutrality. Is it a fear of Russia on their territory, or what exactly?
Well, I'm not sure for Sweden it's a fear of Russia on their territory. Finland, perhaps yes.
Because they had a war in 1939.
Well, they had a war then, the Winter War. But a lot of that was because Finland had been part of the Russian Empire. And Stalin wanted certain key territories back and actually ended up securing those. So during the Cold War, the Finns, of course, were famously neutral, Finlandization, as it was called. But now, after seeing what's happened in Ukraine, seeing Russia push its weight around on things like the pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, the movement of, you know, Russian planes and warships in the Baltic Sea, all this has, I think, made them really very nervous, and not just since the invasion of Ukraine, but even going back before that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Germany, because you mentioned how this was such a big change for Germany, not only for its ties to Russia, but also because it's the first conflict where it's been far more involved militarily, at least in offering military assistance, mm-hmm. than it ever has since World War II. And I think that's sort of a symbolic, I mean, it's the demilitarization that Japan experience has not been to the same extent in Germany, but still there is that general feeling among Germans, isn't there?
Well, there is, and I would say you can draw interesting parallels between Germany and Japan, both having suffered defeat in World War II, then adopting what's essentially a pacifist culture in many respects. A lot of the population very anti-militaristic. But now I think in both countries, realizing that they need to step up and in Germany's case play a larger role in NATO. And in Japan's case, we see that Japan has stepped forward too and been very critical of Russia's move into Ukraine.
So beyond just the being surprised by the unanimity of action in Europe and within NATO, why do you think they have been so unified? Because in many cases, they're going to be hurt economically because they depend on Russian energy. Many of them have ties to trade, to use of exports from Russia. What do you attribute that unanimity to?
Well, I think a lot of it's been the brutality in Ukraine, at least with the annexation of Crimea and then the support for separatists in the Donbass. In 2014, it was essentially, well, I wouldn't really say bloodless. It certainly wasn't in the Donbass. But that was just sort of an ongoing conflict there. This, with the move in, the destruction of Mariupol, the attack on Kyiv, and the atrocities that we've seen, I think that really has called up remembrances of World War II, of Hitler's atrocities, and the feeling that Ukraine is a part of Europe, and this attempt to redraw the boundaries against any number of international laws was totally illegitimate. I just think a lot of them saw that as different than what happened in 2014.
And while some observers have said 2014 is sort of akin to the period where the West tried to appease Germany before World War II, I'm gathering maybe there's a sense that these countries, this is in reaction to the appeasement leading up to World War II, you think?
I think a lot of leaders do view it in those terms, whether or not that's correct. Let's keep another thing in mind, and that is Belarus. While Russia's relations with Belarus had been, warm, but, they hadn't been really together in one bed for quite a while. And then you have these demonstrations against Lukashenko, the president there, in 2020. And Putin's support, I think, enabled him to crack down on those demonstrators. So that's an important preceding event to this. Mm-hmm. And so you have a reinforcement of the tie between Belarus and Russia so that when Putin then decides to invade Ukraine, he can both do it through Belarus and count on Belarus to be able to use their territory and count on that country being isolated also from Europe. So my point is that I think the way Putin views this is in terms of the Eastern Slavic peoples that he needs to reunify, and that is the Russians, the Belarusians, and the Ukrainians. Those are the three large groups. And so he had two out of the three, but Ukraine was far more important than Belarus, much larger. Kyiv, as the original heart of the Eastern Slavic state, ancient Kievan Rus from the 10th century, where Christianity was introduced. All these elements, I think, came together, and that was quite different than, the quick moves into Crimea and the Donbass in 2014.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Ziegler. He's a professor of political science and a university scholar at the University of Louisville. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on the reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both in Europe and outside of Europe. And let's compare to Europe. The rest of the world has been what's been called, quote, the messy middle, unquote. Very few countries actively supporting Russia, but most are, I guess, sitting on what you'd call the geopolitical fence. And I'm sure there's a variety of reasons and a central explanation, that's national interests. But what are some of the various reasons for these countries basically to stay out of it if as best they can?
Well, let me touch on a few of the critical countries. And number one has to be China. And Russia and China have what they call a very close strategic partnership. And this has been evolving really since the early 1990s. It started under Yeltsin. It continued under Putin. And long about 2011, 2012, roughly the same time the U.S. started to pivot toward the Pacific and away from, say, the Middle East, Russia did the same thing. And China is really central to that. They're both authoritarian countries. In a way, they learn best authoritarian practices from each other, if you can call it that. They both are in agreement that they want to see U.S. power restrained. They believe that their sovereignty is threatened by the West. And China, you know, has its grievances against the U.S., against Europe, for the century of humiliation, and for the U.S. or Europe to try to push China to go against Russia. It's more than just self-interest. It is seen as really a form of national humiliation. India is similar but different. Again, India is about the same size as China is, not as powerful economically, not quite as powerful militarily, but India is up and coming. And for all your followers, I'm sure they all follow the news closely, they'll know the U.S. for the past 5-6 years or so has been using the nomenclature of the Indo-Pacific rather than the Asia-Pacific, which means the U.S. wants to bring India in on its side through various arrangements like the Quad group of democratic countries to balance China. Now, India is okay with this to a certain extent because China, they've fought conflicts with and still have border disputes with. But India still has the colonial legacy, and they do not want to be dictated to by any Western powers. They're fiercely independent in their foreign policy. So while they're happy to be part of the U.S. Indo-Pacific grouping, they also want to continue to import weapons from Russia while buying weapons from us.
And that long-standing relationship goes back to the early days of their independence when basically the West cultivated Pakistan at India's expense. I mean, through a good portion of the history, the West provided weapons to Pakistan and the old Soviet Union and Russia provided weapons to India. And of course, those remain to this day very bitter enemies.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting that Russia for the past few years, roughly 5 or 6, has been cultivating Pakistan. And so they are playing this complicated game in the Asian region of trying to maintain and strengthen ties with India, rely very heavily on the strategic partnership with China, which is very important because they don't have to worry about China doing anything in their eastern regions while they are doing something in Europe. And now openings to Pakistan, trying to re-strengthen relations with Vietnam and North Korea while preserving relations with South Korea.
If we can go back to China for a moment, you know, the meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping right before the Olympics began was they declared the No Limits Partnership.
Right.
But as conflict broke out in Ukraine, you've seen rhetoric supporting Russia, but no action. In fact, I was reading one account which says Russian officials are calling, but China is not calling back. So what's going on in that partnership when it comes to this current conflict in Ukraine?
Well, it's very difficult to figure out what exactly is going on in the hierarchy in Beijing. But I think they're conflicted on several accounts. One, the partnership's very important to them. But a second point is that in violating Ukraine's sovereignty, this is something that China has always defended, the idea of sovereignty, the inviolability of territory, meaning for them that certainly Taiwan is part of China, Xinjiang, Inner Mongolia, other places. They don't want to see borders redrawn. And so this troubles them. And while they are supporting Russia against the West, at the same time, they do far more in the way of trade with Europe and with the United States than they do with Russia. So it's a conflicting set of interests. And the indications are that just like what we see in social media in China, where some people take Russia's side and some are critical of Russia, apparently it's the same in the leadership too, with Xi Jinping, I think, having a lot invested in his personal relationship with Putin and the word out that you shouldn't openly criticize Russia, but a lot of talk and debate underneath the table, so to speak, within the Chinese leadership about whether or not this is really in China's best interest.
Beyond those two large nations, there are a range of nations that have either abstained in the original UN resolution or have, there have been a few that have condemned NATO for militarizing Ukraine. Most others are basically hedging their bets because they're economic partners with Russia. How important are those exports of energy, fertilizer, grain, along with weapons in countries within Africa, within South America, towards most of these countries basically sitting on the sidelines or even rhetoric that is sort of equally negative towards both sides? Mm-hmm.
Well, in Africa, for example, you also, like in India, you have the colonial experience. And I think a number of countries in Africa and elsewhere, like India, have become tired of the U.S. or Europe telling them that they, you know, they should go along.
What's best for them.
What the U.S. or Europe want. And China, in particular, has put a lot of money into Africa. Russia has put some in. To a certain extent, they are actually, I think, competing with China for influence. Russia's influence more is this with this Wagner group of mercenaries headed by this Russian oligarch. And so for a lot of them, Russia is willing to go in and support, you know, authoritarian leaders, help keep them in power, provide weapons and so on. The Chinese are willing to come in, do business, buy minerals, buy oil, whatever, provide a lot of money for soccer stadiums and airports. And the U.S. stands by and lectures on human rights and tells them they should be against Russia's actions. So that's where you see countries like South Africa, I think, bridling at the idea that they should just fall in line with the U.S. and Europe. And to a certain extent, the same thing in Latin America with Bolsonaro in Brazil. They buy like 85% of their fertilizer from Russia. They have a fair amount of trade with China. And so while the U.S. is still very important, for many countries, it's just becoming less important. And if that's the case, why simply toe the line that the U.S. wants you to toe?
I've seen several analysis which says that, you know, Russia is really depending on the global South and these countries in the middle as being, if not necessarily an ally, enough of a sideline player that will help them achieve their goals in Ukraine. Do you subscribe to that?
I think that's really the case, yes. Mm-hmm. The fact that you see all the things that Europe is doing to try to wean itself off of Russian energy. And yet Russia has managed to find more outlets. I think the amount, it's at least quintupled, the amount that India is buying of Russian oil. It had been a very small percentage of their imports, like 2%. Now it's up to 8% or more. China's increased the volume of exports somewhat. But for these other countries, too, they need Russian wheat. They need energy. And, yeah, I think that they're saying, you know, look, Europe is far away. We don't really have a dog in that fight. And we have to do what's best for our country.
Along with the Russian wheat, Ukrainian wheat has also been very important. How does that play in these countries' decisions to stay on the sideline if they've depended on Ukrainian wheat, and that Ukrainian wheat might not be forthcoming?
Well, they're in a bind on that. If you think about it, I mean, Russia is blockading the ports. Ukraine can't get it out through the Black Sea. So obviously it's in their interest that this conflict come to an end and that the shipping routes open up. But I think, again, their view is that Russia is a more important player than Ukraine. And while they'd like to see the conflict end, they certainly don't want to antagonize Moscow.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Ziegler. He's a professor of political science and a university scholar at the University of Louisville. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on the reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both in and outside of Europe. I want to ask one more question about this, and that has to do with how NATO's rhetoric, this is a battle between democracy and authoritarianism, has played in certain places with authoritarian regimes. I'm thinking of like the Gulf states, for example. Has that rhetoric sort of frightened some of those states into not taking a side?
No, I don't know if it's frightened them or not. I think what's happening more is that we're seeing more and more a tendency toward authoritarianism around the globe, including in our own country.
True.
There is a substantial portion of our own population that is authoritarian. Surveys show that 27% of conservatives surveyed by the Pew Research Foundation said that they would prefer a military form of government in the United States. That's over a quarter. This is a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just in the U.S. It's in the form of authoritarian populism, and that's in India, that's in Brazil, that's in Hungary, it's in Poland, it's in Britain, it's in Germany, it's in France, the Le Pen experience there. So I think more what's happening is that the U.S. democracy promotion model is being undermined, and we're doing quite a bit to undermine it ourselves because we have ineffective government. We have school shootings. You had a shooting at the hospital here in Tulsa. That makes it very hard to preach to others about bringing democracies together. So I think even if they're favorably inclined, countries that are pretty much democracies like India or South Korea may resent the U.S. Pushing on this. And the authoritarian countries, I think, have very little to worry about.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about European unity. How long will it hold? I know that's a big $64,000 question. But, you know, Russia at this point is on the verge of controlling the Donbas region, the provinces associated with that region. If it and when it controls that region, you could very well see a ceasefire effort from Russia. That could put Ukraine in the position of continuing a war that at least part of Europe doesn't want to see continue. How will that affect that unity we've been talking about?
Well, I think it's going to be harder to maintain unity the longer you go on. As I said earlier, we've already seen, say, from Italy and France, some real push for a negotiated settlement. You've got people like Henry Kissinger saying, well, maybe the Ukrainians should give up some territory. The U.S. position, of course, is that's up to the Ukrainians. We can't really make that call. And you don't know what Zelensky's going to do. I mean, so far, he says the goal is to expel Russia completely from Ukrainian territory. In an ideal world, yes. But I don't think it's going to happen. And as you said, it looks like we're seeing the consolidation of Russian control over the Donbas. Will Putin settle for that? Maybe in the short term. Will he then try to retake all of Ukraine at some point in the future? possibly. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't know. I would hope not. I mean, he's already destroyed a good part of it and killed many people. And we've got, 6 million who've left the country. It's been tremendously destructive. And you don't want to reward that sort of violence and bloodshed, but at the same time, you don't really want it to continue forever either. But it seems like the ultimate scenario is going to be similar to what you have in the Middle East, where it's, you know, land for peace, but neither side really wants to strike a deal over it.
Yeah. Long-term implications for Russia, if and when a peace comes, you know, there have been crippling sanctions. Those have been mitigated by the high cost of energy, mm-hmm. which has helped Russia in that term. But, you know, when the price of energy stays high, more people produce,
right.
and that price will come down. And it's a pariah status in everything from athletics to, you know, just about every facet of their cultural life. How long do you expect that to last? What are the long-term implications for Russia?
Well, I think Russia can limp along, but it's going to be a weaker Russia. Putin has tried to make Russia great again, make it strong again, a great power. But look at how many people have left, and the best and the brightest. You know, the young people, the techies, the people who really should be the future of this country are now in Europe or in Kazakhstan or in Georgia or other places. And, you know, this is not the first time it's happened either. It happened in 2011, 2012, when Putin decided he would come back and be president for a third term. And then if you look at the energy dimension of it, assuming the world can get serious about dealing with climate change, we're going to reduce the demand for fossil fuels. So if you couple that with a Europe that is determined to wean itself off of Russian oil and natural gas, then things don't look good for Russia over the long term. And they've managed pretty well. The central bank under Nabiullina, I mean, she has been a superb executive in that sense in keeping the Russian ruble strong. But again, I think these are palliatives, and over the long run, we're going to see a weaker Russia with even less population, and, you know, the best and the brightest, as I said, are going to be elsewhere.
Mm. Well, Dr. Ziegler, it's a pleasure again to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's been really great. Thank you very much.
Dr. Charles Ziegler is a professor of political science and a university scholar at the University of Louisville. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking about the world's reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.